Well, it is very nice to see everybody here this morning. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with a number of you, as well as other Christian friends around the country that I've met, that have begun with the words, "So, I have this friend at work who's an atheist." Maybe you've had that similar conversation. And I think very recently, a number of things have come to my mind as I've talked to several of you about conversations that you have with friends who are atheists. I thought it would be important to really think about, well, what do we do when we talk to our atheist friends? What are some things that we need to keep in mind? What are some of the objections that they raise when we talk about our faith, our belief in God? And just what are some tips on how to talk to an atheist? Because it's hard when you don't even share a worldview with somebody to find things in common with them. We need to be careful, first of all, let's not assume that every atheist that we meet is smug or arrogant or doesn't like us. Now, certainly there are atheists that we meet that are like that, but you know what? There are also people who claim to be Christians that are smug and arrogant and just don't like people. So let's begin with this idea. Just some initial observations when you're talking to your atheist friends or family members. First of all, absurdly simplified internet memes are not the same thing as reasonable arguments. We need to demand more from them. And so when you have a friend at work who says, "Well, I don't believe in God," and then he gets on Facebook and just shoves a bunch of clever memes at you. What I mean by meme is an image with a catchy phrase attached to it. Maybe a famous quote from an atheist, Richard Dawkins or Ricky Gervais or another celebrity or something like that. That's not the same thing as having reasonable conversations with somebody. And almost always when you do get the internet meme or the funny picture that makes fun of Christians, there's almost always a thread you can pull on it that will untangle the whole thing. An element of weakness behind it. You just have to be smart enough to take it apart and find that weak thread in the argument. If somebody wants to talk about why they don't believe in God and why it's ridiculous for you to believe in God, you must have a conversation, and we need to demand more from people than just dismissing us with something easy or lazy like that. It's okay to go on the offensive also. We don't have to be mousy, defensive people all the time. When it comes to our faith, we must be bold as a lion. We must be willing to say what we believe in spite of the repercussions or in spite of the alienation that sometimes comes along with our profession of faith. Be offensive. Now, don't be offensive. Be offensive in the way that you defend your faith. Be willing to say what you believe and be proactive about it. Question their worldview and how they arrived at it. Because most atheists will try to question your worldview. You only believe in God because you were taught that way from birth. You only believe in God because your parents believed in God. You only go to church because it's a part of your culture, because it's a part of your culture or your heritage. It's a part of what you're used to. Well, question them. How did you arrive at your worldview then? How did you arrive at your worldview? Don't feel bad if you need time to study something. If they do stump you with something, well, tell them, "I'll get back to you on that. It's okay." There's absolutely nothing wrong with simply saying, "I need to take a night to ponder that question. That's a tough one. I see where you're coming from. I get the line of reasoning. Will you give me a day or two to think about that and study it through before I give you an answer?" It would be better to wait a couple days and give an answer that you've thought through than to stick your foot in your mouth and try to answer a stumping question on the spot. Because nothing makes a Christian look more foolish than looking foolish. Don't answer a fool according to his folly. Speaking of foolishness, one of my favorite verses on that subject is in Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 4. Do not answer a fool according to his folly. Because what happens when you answer him according to his folly? You just empower him. You embolden him. You make him think that he actually does have all the answers. Our conversations with atheists must be morally upright. Let's not get into shouting contests. Let's not get into a fist fight. Don't answer him according to his folly, but answer him according to the wisdom and the will of God. And also avail yourself of resources that are available to you. given you a few suggestions here. And by the way, the names and the websites that are up there on the screen, I don't say that everything on these websites is strictly, I think, by God's standard, or that everything that they say is gospel or truth. But when I talk about men like Dr. William Lane Craig or Dr. Frank Turek or Dr. John Lennox, I say that these men on the subject of God's existence are real experts. These are men who know what they're talking about when they defend the existence of God, the validity of His Word, and the resurrection of Jesus. Now, these my men might be orthodox by some standard of faith that we might not believe in, whether it be English Orthodox or something else, but I still recommend them as far as resources go on arguing the existence of God. And I think the same is true of C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis might not have believed everything that we do, but certainly when you read books like Mere Christianity, The Four Loves, The Screwtape Letters, this man did know a thing or two about his faith and defending it. So avail yourself of those kinds of resources. And if you have a hard time defending the existence of God and the Word, well, go to these resources. Go to those who are experts on this subject and use those resources in your own defense. Recently, one of you sent me this meme. You said that you received it from an atheist coworker or friend at work and you found it challenging. So I thought, well, let's do a lesson on it. Ricky Gervais, who is a comedian and TV personality, had this to say. He's also a very famous atheist. The existence of God is not subjective. He either exists or He doesn't. And of course, I think we would all agree with that. It's not a matter of opinion. You can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. Why don't I believe in God? No, no, no. Why do you believe in God? Surely the burden of proof is on the believer. You started all of this. Now, remember that, okay? I want to talk about that in a moment. You started all this. If I came up to you and said, why don't you believe I can fly? You'd say, well, why would I? I'd reply, because it's a matter of faith. If I then said, prove I can't fly. See, you can't prove it, can you? You'd probably either walk away, call security, or throw me out the window. Of course, look for the thread, right? I want you to remember that. Whenever you hear the argument from an atheist or an unbeliever, always look for the thread. Look for the thread and tug on it, and the entire sweater might just fall apart. So where is the logical fallacy in the argument that people like Ricky Gervais are making? First of all, the question of whether we can fly or not is immaterial. Nobody is asking that question. And I think that's a point that needs to be brought out. Nobody is asking the question of can you fly or can't you fly? So it's a non-issue. I don't believe Ricky Gervais can fly, and I don't think Ricky Gervais is claiming that he can fly. So be very careful when the atheist throws out hypothetical situations that are really ridiculous that don't actually apply to real life. And they love to come up with the what-if scenario. What if this? What if that? And yet most of these what-if scenarios wouldn't actually happen in real life and are not actually a concern of anybody. So it's an immaterial question from the very beginning. Ironically, even most atheists would acknowledge that there can only be two answers to the question, does God exist? Either He does or He doesn't. And Ricky Gervais is absolutely correct in that assertion. Now, as to the idea of we brought it up, I would really contend with that. We didn't bring it up. We didn't invent the question of, does God exist? Atheists weren't just happily going along through life and suddenly, out of nowhere, an entire subculture of people invented the idea of God and started questioning everybody around them of, does God exist? Do you believe in Him? Why don't you believe in Him? That's not the case. We didn't bring it up. The question of God's existence is actually an essential inquiry that everybody must ask. Why? Because we're all curious beings. Because we look at the world around us, the universe at large, and we say, where did it come from? Why is it here? What is my purpose in this grand universe of ours? We have an innate sense of our own spirituality. Even the atheist must acknowledge that there is something about the human spirit that is not found in the animal kingdom. Something of our inquisitive nature, our own sense of self-awareness, the questions that we ask, the beauty that we see, the pain that we feel. There's something innately spiritual about us. And dismissing the question of does God exist altogether, or by comparing it to some pointless pursuit, quite frankly, is just lazy and smug. So is the burden of proof on the Christian? Do we have to be the ones that prove God exists? This is typically called presumption atheism. It presumes that God does not exist unless proven otherwise. And at face value, this is the claim that in the absence of the evidence of God, we should just presume that God does not exist. After all, if I was to come up to you and say, there's a giant purple alien on the moon who wants to run planet Earth, all you'd have to do is look through a telescope, look at the moon and say, there is not a giant purple alien on the moon that wants to run planet Earth. There is entirely an absence of evidence. And unless you can prove to me first that there is a giant purple alien on the moon, I have no reason to assume that there is. So let's assume that there isn't one until proven otherwise. And that's the attitude that people take with God as well. Until you prove that God exists, let's just assume that He does not exist. So understood, however, such an alleged presumption seems to conflate atheism with agnosticism. Because when one looks more closely at how people of this presumption use the term atheist, you discover very quickly that they're redefining the word to indicate merely the absence of belief in God, not absence of God Himself. So atheism actually is quite self-defeating. This is something that Dr. William Lane Craig frequently points out in his debates with atheists. He says when he debates an atheist, he has to point out this very simple fact, that when you make the claim, there is no God, you are making what seems like a negative claim, actually a very positive claim. You are saying with certainty, there is no God. Not that you can't know there is no God, which is agnosticism, but that there is no God. And don't you have as much to prove as the believer? If you're going to say that there is no God, you must prove that statement. You must prove it. It is incumbent on the atheist to prove this point, that if God did exist, He would have provided more evidence than what He has. Now understand what I'm saying here. What the atheist is saying is that based on what we can observe of the universe, the creation, based on what we can observe of the way that things work, we cannot believe that there is a God. That it is absurd and unreasonable and illogical to believe in a God based on what we can see of the universe. And if there was a God, then He should have done this, this, and this to prove His existence. Frequently you hear atheists make the argument that if there was a God, all He'd have to do is just show up in the sky and tell all of us that He exists. And unless He does that, He hasn't given us enough information or enough evidence. But the atheist has to prove that, though. In order for atheism to be correct, or at least their assertion that there is no God, they would have to illustrate in some way or prove in some way that if God existed, He would have done more than what we can see. That He would have provided more evidence than what there currently is. Now, Dr. Craig has this to say in response to that. First of all, on at least Christian theism, the primary way in which we come to know God is not evidential, but through the inner work of the Holy Spirit, through the Word, which is effectual in bringing people in a relationship close to God. And that is wholly apart from physical evidence. That is to say, I don't have to touch God to know He exists. I don't have to see God with my own eyes to see His work in the creation. That I see the evidence of God in more than simply handling God. Of course, William Lane Craig also believes in the resurrection, and he believes what the Apostle John said in 1 John chapter 1, that John and the other apostles did in fact touch and see and experience personally the risen Savior Jesus Christ. But to an atheist, that's a point that's immaterial to them. They don't care what the Apostle John has to say. But second, on Christian theism, God has provided the stupendous miracle of the creation of the universe from nothing. And I think that that's exactly what Romans chapter 1 is saying. Go to Romans chapter 1, verse 20, and notice the way that the Apostle Paul puts it here. The tremendous evidence given to us in a physical sense is this, that since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And I will say this, that even in primitive cultures where the gospel has not touched, even in primitive cultures where the Bible has not even been known, where there is not even, where it's not even known that there is a Bible or any other way, even in those kinds of cultures, they look up at the stars, they look at the sun, they feel its warmth on their skin, and they come to the conclusion that something bigger than them is out there. In the absence of Christianity, my friends, people are naturally theistic. They're naturally theistic. Because we can see from the creation itself that there is something bigger than us. But can we arrive at this reasonably? That, I think, is the thing that sticks in the craw of many atheists. That belief in God just doesn't seem reasonable. It just doesn't seem logical. That it's so steeped in tradition and mysticism. That it's so much a part of our culture that nobody could rationally become a believer in God. They are simply born believers in God, and then that is engendered and fostered by the cultural environment around them. Can we arrive at belief in God reasonably? And I think that we can. Now, I don't have time in this context to go through all of these in detail, but I want to just give you five proofs of God's existence. Five proofs of God's existence that any atheist who is logical and reasonable must agree with. Now, I'll say, these are not things that I'm going to say where there's a lot of Bible verses, okay? Because the thing that we have to understand when we talk to an atheist is that quoting Bible verses at an atheist doesn't mean anything. It's like firing paintballs at a tank. The fact is that the atheist must be approached from a rather philosophical point of view because that's where he or she is coming from. And it's those kinds of arguments, if anything, that are going to penetrate the hard exterior to the point where we can bring up the Bible. Because until you believe that there can be a God, there's no point in quoting the book that God wrote. Now, I will quote other Bible verses later on in the lesson, and I believe that the Bible does explain these things, that we don't have to depend on just our own intuition to come up with the belief in God or to validate it or to prove it. All I'm saying to you is that if you're going to talk to an atheist, you have to be equipped with more than Romans 1 verse 20. You have to be equipped with more than Genesis chapter 1, because to them, just like it says in the book of 1 Corinthians, to them, the word is foolishness. To the Gentiles, it just sounds like crazy talk. Five proofs of God's existence. And again, we don't have time to go through all of these. All I want is for you to write these down or log these away or to come back to them at some point watching this video later on our website and do some research on each of these. Do some research on these five proofs and see how you can use them in arguing for the existence of God. So in summation, we'll begin with the cosmological argument from contingency. In short, this is the cosmological argument from contingency. Everything that exists has an explanation for its existence. Now, we might not always fully know that explanation, but we know that it must have an explanation. If you were walking through the woods one day with a friend of yours, and you came across a glass orb just sitting in the middle of the woods, you might say, Well, I wonder where this glass orb came from. This is a very unnatural thing to find in the middle of the wilderness. But what if your friend was to say, well, looking around here, I don't know where it came from, so it must not have come from anywhere. It must not have a reason for its existence or an explanation for its existence. You'd look at him like he was crazy. Obviously, it has an explanation for its existence. You might not fully know that explanation, but you know that it must have an explanation. That glass orb is there because somebody made it and put it there. Everything has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature, like numbers, for example. The number four exists not because somebody created it, but because it necessarily exists. The number four, the number seven, mathematical equations and mathematical proofs, those things simply exist out of necessity. Or it exists because of an external cause, because something created it. And again, just because you don't know everything about an explanation doesn't mean it doesn't have an explanation or that a partial explanation is invalid. So that's the first proposition. The second is this, that if the universe has an explanation, that explanation is God. Now you might think, well, that's a pretty bold statement, isn't it? But think about this. If this universe has an explanation, its explanation must be bigger than the universe itself, right? And we did this point in a lesson a few months ago back in August. Look it up, called Does God Exist? We talked about this very point. That if this universe did come into existence and has an explanation, its explanation must be bigger than it. And it must exist outside of the realm of it. Which means that the explanation for the universe's existence must be non-physical, or else it had to have been created itself. So it has to be non-physical. It has to be eternal, timeless. Otherwise, it's bound by the rules of time within this existence. It must be omnipotent, or at the very least, so incredibly powerful that all the power in the universe began because of it, whatever that explanation is. It must be personal, because something had to decide to create the universe. Otherwise, again, it's simply a natural phenomenon. And it has to have a will. All of these things must be true. So, if the universe has an explanation, the only explanation can be God. Now, the third proposition is this. The universe does exist, right? And if your atheist friend doesn't think the universe exists, he's got much bigger problems than you in his life. Therefore, and here's the conclusion, therefore, because the universe exists, and the only logical explanation is God, then God exists. Now, it's a logically airtight argument. That is to say that if all the premises can be proven to be true, then the conclusion is unavoidable. The atheist might not like the conclusion, but he must accept that the conclusion is true. It is true. Second is this, and again, I wish I had an hour to talk about all these things, but you probably don't want me to talk for an hour about each of these. The second is this, the so-called Kalam cosmological argument based on the beginning of the universe. The term Kalam comes from the Arabic word for theology. This idea or this explanation for God's existence came about because of Middle Age Muslim theologians. So, in short, the Kalam cosmological argument is this. Everything that begins to exist has a cause, right? You have a cause. You are an effect of a cause, right? We know cause and effect. If you knock a domino over, what's the effect? It knocks over. And it knocks over the next domino. And it knocks over the next domino. And in a whole series of dominoes, you have a series of causes and effects. So everything that we see is an effect of some cause. You are the effect of your parents. Your parents are a cause, and you were the effect. You were the result of them. But they are also the effect of their parents' cause. And they are the effect of their parents' cause. And you go back and back and back and back and back all the way to the beginning. Eventually, you have to boil everything down to there must have been a first cause that started everything. So, everything that begins to exist has a cause. The second proposition is the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. This is an incredibly powerful argument, because even the majority of the scientific community has accepted the Big Bang Theory. The Big Bang Theory being that at some point in the distant past, everything that exists began to exist. And before it began to exist, nothing existed. That is true mathematically. That is true by the laws of physics as well. Even Albert Einstein understood that the universe had a beginning. And physicists, cosmologists, and mathematicians ever since then have accepted that truth. That is the Kalam cosmological argument. Again, there's more that could be said of that one, but let's move on to the third one. The moral argument based on moral values. And that is this: if God does not exist, then objective morals and values and duties do not exist, right? If there is no God, if there is no divine controller of the universe, if there is no divine creator, if there is no divine moral agent of all the universe and all that is in it, then moral duties and values also do not exist, because we are not accountable to anything greater than ourselves. If we're just animals, then why not act like animals? Animals steal from each other. Animals kill each other all the time. Animals have no regard or respect for relationships. They're just animals. And there are many things that are illegal in human culture that are perfectly acceptable among the animals. So if God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. Now, the atheist might object to that and say, well, I believe in morals and duties. Well, I'm sure that you do. And I'm not saying that atheists are evil people. I'm not saying that atheists are incapable of morals. All we're saying is this: objective morals cannot exist. However, objective moral values and duties do exist. Because even among atheists, they find things repugnant and objectionable. For example, brainwashing children by religion. And if your atheist friend doesn't believe in objective morals and duties, then simply ask him, is it morally right to brainwash a child to believe in God? He'll stump him for sure. He might walk away from you at that point, but he has to accept that some objective moral values and duties do exist. He must accept that. And if moral values and duties do exist, then God exists. Fourth, the teleological argument from fine-tuning. I would recommend that you go back to that Does God Exist lesson from August for more details on this, because there are so many things in our world and so many things in our universe that make life possible. And if just one were to change in the smallest way imaginable, life itself would not be possible. Let's keep that in mind here. And again, I just really would like you to think back on that lesson. I'll say one thing from Dr. William Lane Craig. When scientists say that the universe is fine-tuned for life, they don't mean designed. Rather, they mean that small deviations from the actual values of the fundamental constants and quantities of nature would render the universe life-prohibiting, or alternatively, that the range of life-permitting values is incomprehensibly narrow in comparison with the range of assumable values. Richard Dawkins himself, citing the work of the astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees, acknowledges that the universe does exist, does exhibit this extraordinary fine tuning. So the simple way to make the teleological argument is this: the fine tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. I believe that it can be proven that it is not due to physical necessity or chance. Therefore, it is due to design. And any design must have a designer. And the last one that we'll look at, since we're running out of time here, is the resurrection itself. Now, your atheist friend might not be very impressed with the resurrection, but they'd better be. Because the resurrection itself attests to the God of the Bible. 2,000 years ago, there was an empty tomb. It was an empty tomb. And it has been shown historically that a man named Jesus of Nazareth, a real person who actually existed, was killed on a cross in Jerusalem. He was buried because a body's got to go somewhere. And after 3 days in that grave, by Sunday morning, that grave was empty. Even Jesus' enemies knew that the grave was empty. Even Jesus' enemies had to acknowledge that something happened to that body. Now, while they were fumbling around with what is probably the greatest blunder in all of human history as far as information relations go, Jesus was walking about amongst his disciples, showing himself to numerous witnesses who could attest to his life. He was risen. And that itself, I think, must be reckoned in the mind of the atheist. It is a proof that God is real. We don't have time to go any further into this conversation. There were a number of other things I wanted to talk about this morning that are just going to have to become part two. And that's okay, because I think there's nothing more that we could say that is more important, no subject that is more valuable to our conversations with our unbelieving friends than to show God exists, to prove His existence, that it is reasonable, it's logical to come to the conclusion, not because you've been brainwashed or because you're used to it or because your parents believed it or because you had some irrational emotional response, but it is reasonable and it is logical. In fact, I would say it is the most logical conclusion to believe that there is a God who is all-powerful, who is eternal, who created all things by His own word, who is personal and has a will, and who is all good and benevolent, and who cares very much about you and the eternal destination of your soul. Now, if you'd like to respond to that God, then let your spiritual need be known while together we stand and sing.